Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks so much for tuning in again. I'm Neil Stavem, and we get together on a regular basis here to find ways that we can connect faith to life, to apply biblical principles to daily life situations. And I think you'll find today's discussion will be helpful, challenging, and hopefully a bit of life-changing as well. Ryan Thomas there at the controls. And Ryan, we do want to mention again that we have the pastor appreciation opportunity to sign up online for that, myfaithradio.com. And that's a great opportunity for to be able to send your pastor and spouse away for a week getaway.
I like the way you phrased that, send them away for a week.
Well, that's okay. Okay.
So, but it is a positive thing.
But invite them back. Invite them back. That was the difference. Yes.
Fair point.
There are a number of people that perked up their ears right there. Hey, tell me more. All right, myfaithradio.com is where you'll find that. By the way, when you go on to myfaithradio.com, you'll find a great resource called Prayer Works. And on a regular basis here on Faith Radio, we like to take a day to focus on prayer as one of the great joys that we have as followers of Christ, and certainly a need. And Prayer Works is an online opportunity for you to leave a prayer request, something that is a burden, a concern for you, and know that others will be praying for you. So you can check that out, Prayer Works. It's on our website, myfaithradio.com, and it sort of ties in with today's topic, because I've been looking forward to talking with today's guest for some time, and we're going to talk about, as I was just looking in one of the chapters in the book, we're going to talk about doing something radical, I thought you'd appreciate. We're going to talk about solitude and silence. How do we talk about solitude and silence with you and I together? I guess that's the question we'll wrestle with maybe early on with my guest Ruth Haley Barton. Let me just here's a quote from her book. She said, "The practice of solitude and silence practices are radical because they challenge us on every level of our existence. They challenge us on the level of culture, because there's obviously very little in our culture that supports that idea of sort of being still and quiet and you feel unproductive. They confront us on the level of our human relationships, because they call us away from those relationships for a time so we can give undivided attention to God." That's kind of countercultural as well. Mm-hmm. "They challenge us on the level of our soul. In the silence, we become aware of inner dynamics that we've been able to avoid by keeping ourselves noisy and busy. They draw us into spiritual battle and silence. There's the potential for each of us to know that I'm God with such certainty that the competing powers of evil and sin and the ego self can no longer hold us in their grip." That's some of what we're going to address today as we talk about a wonderful book called Invitation to Solitude and Silence, Experiencing God's Transforming Presence. Let me introduce our guest. Ruth Haley Barton is founding president of the Transforming Center, a spiritual formation ministry to pastors and Christian leaders. She's a trained spiritual director, a teacher, and retreat leader, and she's served on the pastoral staff of several churches, including Willow Creek Community Church. Sought-after teacher, preacher, and consultant to leadership teams, and currently adjunct professor of spiritual transformation at the Northern Seminary. And she's written several works, including Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership. She's co-authored An Ordinary Day with Jesus, Experiencing the Reality of God in Your Everyday Life. And we're happy to talk about Invitation to Solitude and Silence. It's not something that we've talked about, I don't think, much before. Ruth, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm so glad to make the connection today.
Oh, great. It's good to be with you.
I found in the opening pages of your book a wonderful couple of paragraphs, and I'm not going to read it all, but it just really captured my attention, I guess, and it was such a good visual. You talk about God's invitation is a winsome one, but it's not casual. It's an invitation from His very heart to the depths of our being. It warrants serious consideration, because it's an invitation to a journey or something we've been longing for all our lives. Unlike a trip designed to get us somewhere as efficiently as possible, a journey or a quest requires us to leave familiar dwelling places for strange lands we cannot yet envision. Without knowing when we'll return, this journey requires a willingness to say goodbye to life as we know it, because our hearts are longing for something more. And I found that, any time we spend time pursuing God's presence, that there is that longing that comes out. Ruth, is this something that you experienced in your life? And so this passion about spiritual transformation sort of came out of that deep longing for you?
Absolutely. Yep. I've been a Christian since I was 4 years old. I'm a pastor's kid, and I was saved in family devotions when I was 4 years old. And so I've been walking with the Lord for a long time, and there came a point in my own journey where I felt like I had tried everything that had been offered to me in our Protestant evangelical tradition, typical Bible study methods and preaching services and small groups and Christian self-help and all that sort of thing, and yet still was aware that I wasn't changing in the deep inside places of my being, and that I wasn't experiencing the intimacy with God that I had experienced early on in my spiritual life either. And so as I got more and more in touch with my longings and gave myself permission to feel my longing and desire for God and to admit that the Christian life felt pretty empty, that's when it seemed to open up a space for God to lead me in some new directions, particularly into the journey of solitude and silence, which is new perhaps to some of us, but it's really very old in our own Christian tradition. All the great ones of our faith practiced it. Jesus did, Moses did, Elijah did, Paul did. So we're in very good company and long-standing company when we take a journey into solitude and silence.
Let's talk about the journey. So how is solitude, the search for solitude, more like a journey than a trip? Define that a little bit more.
Yes. Well, a trip, usually the destination is the most important thing. So you just plot the quickest course to get there, and you push on through the night and do whatever you have to do, and you take the quickest route. You don't care about the scenic view or anything like that. The destination is the destination. And a journey, some people have put it this way, that the journey is the destination, that it's the journey itself that changes you, and you're not in such a hurry because being on the journey is the point. And you expect to be changed by the journey. You expect it to be challenging. You expect to stop along the way and see things as you're led to do so. And with a journey, especially in classic literature and stuff, the journey usually returns you home to the very place you began. That's the other really interesting thing about the journey motif, is that the journey is a trip in the sense that you are initially going somewhere, but the end of the journey is to usually end up back where you began on some level, except you're changed. Maybe nothing in your situation has changed, but you are different because of the encounters, because of the journey, because of what's happened to you, and you bring a different self back. And so, you know, everything then changes around you in some ways because you're different.
So is the, I guess maybe not to be, you know, sort of focused on that trip side of it, but is the goal, is the objective of this that we are changed, or that we just begin to understand and experience God more? Or is it mm-hmm. all of those things?
It's both together. The subtitle of the book is Experiencing God's Transforming Presence. And so, yes, we discover more about God. And even more important than knowledge about God is the encounter. Because we cannot really encounter the living God without being fundamentally changed. You know, like Isaiah in the Old Testament, when he was in the presence of God, he completely fell on his face. He said, "Woe is me, for I'm a man of unclean lips." You know, that being in the presence of God, the transforming presence of God, will transform us utterly. So it's both. It's the desire to have that encounter and to be changed by that encounter. And we will be. There is no way to be in the transforming presence of God really without being changed.
And as we kind of alluded to at the beginning, I mean, we're in a society that doesn't, I mean, we're kind of all about efficiency, aren't we? There's not a lot of let's stop and really encounter much.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is that it's radically countercultural as it relates to secular culture, but it's radically countercultural as it relates to many Christian subcultures as well. That the Christian subculture can be extremely activistic and very word-oriented, and especially contemporary models of church with loud music and lots of programming and all that sort of thing. It's just, even the Christian subculture doesn't encourage the Christian practices of being still and knowing that God is God. It kind of goes against something there as well. Now, technology is another huge issue in the secular culture. I think technology is neutral, but I think many of us have accepted technologies into our lives without even considering the impact on our spiritual lives and on our psyches. And so the ever-presence, the ubiquitous nature of technology, now you can have your work and your noise strapped right to your body with you all the time, that also makes it extremely difficult and countercultural to practice solitude and silence. You have to work a whole lot harder at it because there are no natural spaces anymore. You know, it used to be that in an agricultural environment, you know, you'd be alone on the tractor. You know, you'd be alone in the garden, and times like that would be sort of built in. Or when you were in the car, it wouldn't have been possible to be on a phone. Or when you were on vacation, you would be disconnected. And now, because we can be connected all the time, even the natural spaces for a little bit of silence and stillness have been completely eradicated almost.
I'm just thinking about sitting out in the tractor now. You got Ryan and I just kind of going back to early days of good times. So we're talking with...
Well, yeah, and I've had people like that approach me after speaking, and they'll say, you know what, this wasn't an issue for me the way I was raised because we had all that sort of built in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We're in a moment or two, we're going to talk a little bit about, you use Elijah's story as kind of a Elijah in, was I think, First Kings 19, isn't it, where he's had the high point, that experience, Mount Carmel, the prophets of Baal are killed, but, and then he runs back, there's rain, and then Jezebel says, you know, we'll see about tomorrow if you're not going to be like one of my prophets. And so then he runs away into the wilderness or walks away. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that and expand how you develop that story kind of over the course of the book. But I'm wondering, at the end of each chapter, you do take a moment or two just to provide a little practice, a little sort of tangible idea. So even though we've not really spent much time talking about solitude and silence other than the basics, is there something that you would say maybe just in terms of a start for someone that says, I want to build this into my life where I don't have the natural spaces? What do you recommend?
Well, one very natural thing could be to pay attention to our breathing, even to take 60 seconds at the beginning of a day or 60 seconds when you get into work at your desk or 60 seconds at the midday around lunchtime. And just sit for 60 seconds, close your eyes, and breathe deeply and pay attention to your breath. And become aware of the fact that you're breathing, your breath is a gift from God. You know, many people think that if you talk about breathing, you're going to become a Buddhist or something. But it's really not true because God is the one who gave each and every one of us our breath. I mean, he gave it to the first man and the first woman, and he gives us our breath at every single moment. So to take 60 seconds at a couple different points during the day, and to just close your eyes and pay attention to your breathing and feel God's presence as he gives you your breath, experience the fact that your breath is coming from God and that God is using your breath to affirm your life and to enliven you and to receive that as the gift that it is. Breathing slows you down. It brings more oxygen to the brain. It can also put you in touch with the Spirit of God, whom the scriptures say is closer to us than our breath, that the Holy Spirit is the breath of God. And so when we breathe physically, we can become aware of the Holy Spirit, who is to our spiritual lives what our physical breathing is to our physical bodies. Breathing can be very powerful for accomplishing several different things along these lines.
All right. We're going to take 60 seconds and take some time to breathe. And then we're going to continue our discussion with Ruth Haley Barton, who is the founding president of the Transforming Center. The Spiritual Formation Ministry to Pastors and Christian Leaders, and she's authored several books. The one we're referencing from University Press is called Invitation to Solitude and Silence, Experiencing God's Transforming Presence. And it's our hope that by the end of this hour that you'll have some practical steps and ways to enter into this opportunity to know God more and to experience the change that comes with that. And we'd love to have you join the conversation if you'd like, as maybe just tell some of your experiences in pursuing solitude and silence. It's 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484.
I think that when we as Christians are challenged by God, we need to realize the real change starts with I. It's reading the Bible as God himself, absolute love and truth, and asking oneself, am I being kind towards someone I don't agree with, an enemy even? Do I love them? And what does that look like according to the way God loves me? Am I forgiving as God forgives and choosing not to recall the offense? Am I thankful in all things and for all things? These are Am I questions that we all need to answer, because revival starts with me. I looked in the mirror this morning after reading 2 Corinthians 3:18 and thought, is this true of me? Am I continuing to behold the Word of God as if I were looking in a mirror at the glory of the Lord? Am I constantly being transfigured into His very own image in ever-increasing splendor and from one degree of glory to another? I am, if I am looking to the Lord, for this comes from Him who is the Spirit every day. For more encouragement, visit DebbieGriffith.com.
When I am alone, oh, and when I am alone, and when I am alone, give me Jesus.
We want to experience God's transforming presence. And to help us in that, we're extending an invitation to solitude and silence. And that's the title of Ruth Haley Barton's book. Ruth is kind enough to join us today. She's a founding president of the Transforming Center. It's a spiritual formation ministry to pastors and Christian leaders. She's a trained spiritual director, teacher, and retreat leader. And we're talking about this wonderful resource. Maybe before we talk a little bit about Elijah, solitude and silence are considered some of the disciplines. How would you distinguish them maybe from other disciplines that our early church fathers at least practiced?
Yes. Could you ask that question again?
Yeah, just how solitude and silence compare with some of the other disciplines, or maybe even why they were included. I guess we think about the list of all that might be considered, disciplines that we should practice, and just these are sort of unique, it seems to me.
Yes, well, solitude and silence were definitely practiced from long ago. We know that the people in the Old Testament did it, and Jesus did it, and then there are other traditions that are better at this than we are, so solitude and silence definitely had more of a place in the Catholic tradition, more sacramental traditions early on. And we got away from some of that in the Reformation. You know, we threw the baby out with the bathwater just a little bit. And then as Protestants, we tend to be a little bit more activistic, and sometimes it's to the exclusion of some of the quieter disciplines that have to do with being still in God's presence and allowing God to be the active one in our lives. So I think that the resurgence of interest in solitude and silence is a wonderful corrective to some imbalance that has been there. I think it's very exciting. And even the Protestant concept of the quiet time has oftentimes been a little bit activistic. You know, we have our Bible studies and our prayer plans and our teaching tapes and all of that, and there's very little place in there for God to be the one who initiates, because we're coming in with the agenda. So solitude and silence, especially silence, actually creates a little bit more space for God to do what God knows to do, rather than us always coming in with our agenda.
I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but let's set up maybe just the Elijah story, because that, one of the things that is sort of an interesting part of the story is that, I mean, obviously he needed rest. He went 40 days into, he was coming off an emotional experience. He sits down on a broom tree and says, "Lord, can basically take my life." If we actually jump into solitude and silence, and as you even talk about in the book, I mean, the first few times you realize that, what I really need is a nap, maybe. I mean, is that okay?
Yeah. It is. And in fact, sometimes people have years and years of guilt about the fact that they feel like they fall asleep in prayer. And then rather than feeling guilty, I would rather people just pay attention to their exhaustion and paid attention to what that says about their life and the way that they're living their life, that here we want to be present to God, we love God, we want to have these times of intimacy with God, and we're too tired for the very thing that we say that we want. So solitude could, in the very beginning, lead us to a place of looking at our lifestyles and looking at whether or not we're getting enough rest and sleep so that we can do the things that are most important to us in life. And many times, including in Elijah's story, God leads us to rest first. And I believe, actually, that solitude needs to be cultivated as a place of rest in God before it can be anything else. And I think that's one place where it may differ from the more of the contemporary idea of quiet time is that rather than doing so much, we're invited to first of all learn how to rest in God and how to experience solitude as that place of rest. So there's a chapter in the book on helping us to identify whether or not we're dangerously tired, and then there's a whole chapter on rest for the body, a whole chapter on rest for the mind, and a whole chapter on rest for the soul, because all of those are different aspects of resting that we can cultivate in solitude and silence.
One of the things that, as I was reading the story again, obviously Elijah, you know, he rest, you know, the angels took provided for him, but then he went up and took a 40-day journey on in further into the desert. You know, I keep thinking about that. So who has that time, that kind of time to commit to experiencing God's presence? I mean, you know, he was going to go to Mount Horeb and experience God. But, I mean, in reality, it seems like our lives are almost too busy to even think about carving out any sort of extended time, let alone maybe even a short little quiet time.
Right. Well, I think there's two possibilities here. First of all, there can be a substantive practice of solitude and silence if we're more committed to it regularly, so shorter periods of time regularly. But I also think there are seasons in our lives where God does invite us into an extended period of time, and that's why I use the word invitation, because sometimes we're invited into that through an illness or through an accident or through the loss of a job or through a period of grieving or whatever, or sometimes it's because of longing and desire, and we say, I just don't care anymore. I want God more than I want anything, and I am going to rearrange my life so that I can get a day, or so that I can, you know, get, you know, a weekend or something like that. We find time for everything else we really want. That's the way it seems to me, that we find time for the vacations. We find time for the business trips. We find time for our training and our education. I think if we really want this, we can find it. We can. It's going to be radical, though, and countercultural, and we're going to have to know how bad we want it in order to be able to find ways to rearrange our lives for this kind of intimacy.
Is there a point where maybe resistance to solitude typically comes? Is it again just say I'm too busy, or just talk about maybe the resistance points and how we start breaking some of those down?
Yeah. Well, I call it the push-pull phenomenon. That there's the simultaneous experience of being drawn and being resistant. And when that happens, I always encourage people when I'm in spiritual direction with them, when you feel that push-pull phenomenon where you've got both going on at the same time, being drawn and also being resistant, that is always a place where God is at work. Because usually it's the true part of yourself that is being drawn, and it's the ability to tell more truth in that true place. And then the resistance comes from that which is false within us. And because the evil one knows that as we practice solitude and silence, as the psalmist says, be still and know that I am God. And the word know is that Hebrew word that has to do with full knowing between the object and the subject, not just intellectual knowing, but the kind of intimacy that passes between a husband and a wife, full knowing. That we will have that knowing in solitude and silence, and it will change us. God will take his rightful place on the throne of our lives, and the evil one will do anything to fight that. And so the resistance, I believe, is the evil one, and that which is false within us, believing that we don't have time, not being willing to do what it would take, being afraid to be in touch with how bad we really want God and how much we're missing God, and not being willing or believing that we really can change our life for it. And then, you know, whatever the distractions are that Satan throws our way. And he gets really busy in the early part of our solitude experience. Satan gets really busy throwing up all sorts of distractions and excuses to convince us that we can't do it, or we shouldn't do it, or, you know, we're not allowed to do it, or whatever.
Ruth, we have just two minutes before have to take a break at the bottom, but I'm wondering if could you sort of give us another, an invitation, another practice, something that we could begin to apply or think about here in 60 to 90 seconds or so.
Yes. Given what we were just talking about, this is really simple. But when we sit in these silent moments with God where we don't have our own human agenda going, our own Bible study plan and prayer plan and the CD that we're going to listen to and all that, we can actually sit with our hands open on our laps as we breathe. And because Psalm 46:10, the literal translation of that word, be still, is Rapha. That's the Hebrew word Rapha, which means to let go of your grip. That actually sitting with your hands open can actually be a tangible way of seeking to release distractions, seeking to release our agendas and all the ways that we cling and grasp at our own security. It's also a very symbolic way of saying to God, my hands are empty. I'm willing to receive what you have for me today. So I would suggest actually coupling the silence with sitting with your hands open as a way of letting go of the things you usually cling to, as well as expressing to God your willingness to receive whatever he has to give.
The invitation to solitude and silence. We are thankful for Ruth Haley Barton's teaching and insight on that. Subtitle of her book is called Experiencing God's Transforming Presence, and that ultimately is what we want more than anything else. Ruth is a spiritual director, a teacher, an author, and retreat leader, and she's a founder of the Transforming Center, a ministry of spiritual formation to pastors and Christian leaders, along with other congregations and organizations that they serve. And she's written several books, including Sacred Rhythms, A Longing for More, and the one we're talking about today, Invitation to Solitude and Silence. And we've got a couple of copies of the book that we'd be happy to send your way. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so with a phone call at 877-933-2484, or you can connect with us on Facebook. It's Connecting Faith with Neil Stabum, and we'll continue with Ruth Haley Barton in just a moment. Pursuing experiencing God, experiencing God's transforming presence. And that's what our focus is today. And we're doing that through the invitation to solitude and silence. That's the title of Ruth Haley Barton's book from University Press. She's written several, including Sacred Rhythms, Longing for More, Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership, all from University Press. Ruth serves as, she's founder of the Transforming Center. It's a ministry of spiritual formation to pastors and Christian leaders, along with the congregations and organizations that she's served. She's a sought-after speaker and retreat leader, and we're just thankful to have a little time talking with her today about solitude and silence. And Ruth, one of the things that you address in the book, and I certainly could understand that we, you know, we have a tendency, a natural tendency, I think, probably, that we want to clean up first before coming to God. How do we come just as we are?
Yeah. Well, I used to try to get it all together before I came into God's presence. So I wanted to get my emails all answered and my voicemail cleared out and all my relational junk situated and even the bathroom floor clean, you know, before I came into God's presence. And I realized that I would come into God's presence absolutely exhausted and frazzled from trying to make it all perfect as though God cared. And that was an important lesson for me, because I realize now that God just wants me to come, and solitude is a little bit more like a game of musical chairs where, you know, you go round and round and round while the music of your life is playing, and then you stop the music and you sit down right where you are, and you're with God right where you are. And I think even another beautiful definition of solitude is to be with God with what is. I love that idea, to be with God with what is. And that's what Elijah did, which is why Elijah's story drew me in, I think, was because he was such a mess when he went into solitude. He was exhausted, depressed, depleted, and running for his life, and certainly not the great spiritual leader that we saw in 1 Kings 18. And that's what he did. He slumped down under the solitary broom tree, and he was with God with what was true about him, which was that he was depleted, that he wanted to die, and he didn't care anymore. And if we could just get that honest with God, that would be the best starting place. Sometimes I encourage people when I teach on this to just say the truest thing you know how to say to God. Start your solitude time by just saying the truest thing you know how to say to God and trusting that God wants to be with you right there. And it opens up a space for God to be with you right where you are, which means that's right where you need it most, you know?
You know, it's one thing to sort of bring our bodies to a place of rest, and you know, we've sort of talked about that, and Elijah needed to, I mean, he needed to get his rest in. I mean, we need that as well in our busy lives, but the challenge of settling our mind, I know you addressed that as well, but that seems like that's maybe even more difficult.
Yes, for many of us it is, and when we start to practice solitude and silence, the first thing we realize is just how chaotic we are and how riled up we are on the inside and how the mind never stops working and trying to figure things out and put things into words and categories and systems of thought and tries to make sense out of things and problem solve and all that. And so the first thing that we become aware of is just how, after we become aware of how tired we are physically, then we become aware of how distractible we are at the level of the mind. And so that's why I wrote a whole chapter on how to practice resting the mind. And one little metaphor I use is to think about sitting in the light of the moon, and that it's one thing to point to the moon and talk about how the light of the moon refracts from the sun and all that sort of thing in a very scientific way and to know something about it. It's very different to just sit in the light of the moon and experience the beauty and to allow it to illuminate everything around and to notice how beautiful it is and just experience the beauty of it. And that's what we do when we rest the mind. We say, thank you very much to the mind. You've helped me a lot, but right now I'm letting you rest so that I can just be in God's presence. Henry Nouwen talks about allowing the mind to rest into the heart. So we're not dismissing the mind and we're not dismissing the intellect. They are great gifts, but in solitude and silence, we rest them. We let them rest.
You were talking about Henry Nouwen. One of his quotes, he said, the solitude is not a private place, but a place of conversation. So let's talk a little bit more about that conversation part of it.
Yeah, and he also says it's not a private therapeutic place. It's a place of our own transformation and conversion. That in that place, we begin to see God as God really is, and we begin to see ourselves more clearly in light of God's presence, like Isaiah did, you know, where he's completely undone. And he says, you know, I'm a man of unclean lips. You know, we see God, and then we see ourselves in the light of God's presence. And then we are drawn to conversion. We see ourselves as we are. We see the places where we need God's help for further transformation, and all we can do is fall down on our faces and say to God, what most needs to be done in my life, you will have to do it, because there are some tweaks and things I could bring about for myself, but the real change, you're going to have to do it. And that's where the conversation is, as you know, we talk with God about those things.
It's an invitation to solitude and silence, experiencing God's transforming presence. Ruth Haley Barton is my guest today. Let's take a call from Denise. Denise, listening in on iSanity. Denise, go ahead. You're on with Ruth.
Hi, Ruth. Thank you so much for this topic. I just couldn't have been better timing for me. I just recently lost my job, and I just realized that the Lord has given me this time for rest and restoration. Yeah. And I know that it's been a struggle these past couple weeks to give him the first fruits of each morning, to just spend that extra time and to just be still and to listen and invite him into my day. And I have been diligent, but I have also missed several days. And it's just so interesting how when I do offer up the first fruits of my time, that he just supernaturally increases my productivity throughout the day, the smoothness. And not that it's all easy, but that he just shows up in his presence so much more present, as far as I'm able to perceive, than those days where I rush through my morning routine. And I could identify with you wanting the floor clean even before, and then you're so exhausted. And I just wanted to praise God for how faithful he is when we do give that sacrifice of time. And also I wanted to get your input on, you know, it occurred to me that Elijah, when he was faithful and when he spent that time with the Lord, one of the benefits he reaped from that, I believe, if I'm accurate, is Elisha. He was then given a friend. And I thought, oh, Lord, are you preparing me to be more giving, more able to have something for others through friends by first being with you, so that I can be replenished and I can truly be a friend. What are your comments on that?
Good word, Denise. Thanks for your call.
Yes. Yes, well, you're right to, you know, mention that one of the benefits of solitude and silence, the way I put it and address that in the book, is the fact that God gave Elijah some guidance that he needed. And that I think it's the second to last chapter of the book on finding guidance, that a very natural result of being in solitude and silence is that God does give us guidance for our lives. And for Elijah, it was sort of two-pronged. Elisha wasn't as much of a friend as he was someone. I mean, I'm sure he was a friend, but God, I think, was saying to Elijah, you know, the way you've been living your life is unsustainable for you. You need to share the mantle of leadership, because Elisha was to be appointed as prophet, and Elijah was to share his mantle of leadership with Elisha. So it was a friendship, perhaps, but it was more than friendship. It was a shared leadership, and God saying, in order for you to sustain your life for the long term in my service, you're going to need to share the mantle of leadership. So Elisha's your guy. Go appoint him as a junior prophet, and in that way, you'll be able to sustain your life. until I call you home, until the chariot swings low and calls you home, you'll have a sustainable life. And so that's part of what I see, too, in that aspect of Elisha's story, is that God does deal with us about how we're living our life and helps us to find a way of life that's more sustainable. He also received guidance for appointing a new king in Israel as well. So God actually gave him a strategic, tactical bit of guidance, too, for his life and vocation. So that's a little bit more of what I see in that part of Elijah's story. The main point being that God gave him guidance, and we all need guidance. And in solitude, we don't have to wrestle it from God. God gives it quite naturally, as he knows that we're open to him.
Should we expect answers or questions? I mean, obviously, you know, God's question to Elijah is, what are you doing here, Elijah? I mean, should we expect that this will be a time of questions?
Yes. In fact, one of the things I believe about spiritual formation and our spiritual journeys is that at times the questions we're willing to ask ourselves or to allow God to ask us are more important than the answers we think we know. And the reason for that is that the answers we think we know are sort of like closed rooms and closed boxes where there's no room for God to do or say anything new. You know, we have figured it out. We got God in the box. We're not looking for anything new. We've got the answer. Whereas the right question at the right time can actually throw open a door or a window so that some new wind of the Holy Spirit can blow in and through our lives. And so a good question like the one that God asked Elijah, what are you doing here, Elijah? If we can choose to answer God as honestly as we can, because Elijah could have fudged a little bit. He could have said, oh, I just need a little bit of a break, just on a walk, something like that. But he went all the way to the bottom with it. He took that question and used it for all it was worth, and it elicited a rush of self-disclosure, what I call the good, the bad, and the ugly. And he let that question just bring it all out in God's presence, which brought about the real encounter. You know, first there was the wind, you know, the earthquake and the fire. God was not in any of those. And eventually the silence when the chaos settled. And then Elijah had the life-changing encounter with God, which was the sound of sheer silence, and he wrapped his face in his mantle. And he just stood there in that presence, because that's the presence that transforms us. That's what we need. That becomes our sustenance. That becomes the bedrock of our being. And so the questions in the beginning might stir up quite a bit of chaos like it did for Elijah. But then eventually, if we can just wait through it and stand in it, the chaos settles, and then we experience the presence of God in ways that change us utterly.
I'm sure it's been an age-old question, but, you know, how do we know if it's God speaking to us? I mean, it seems like there's plenty of examples of people who said, well, they heard a word from the Lord. But any thoughts there?
Well, I think it's part of it. It's with practice. We learn to distinguish God's voice as being distinct from all the other voices. And, of course, the other voices are the voices from outside of ourselves, you know, the voices of expectation and culture and family of origin and, you know, all that. But there are also voices inside of us, too, compulsive voices, the voices of our own ego-driven self or false performance-oriented self or whatever it is that we've got going on internally as well. And it's familiarity. I think that we get to know the voice of God as being familiar, just like we learn another human voice. It comes through experience. And God's voice has a qualitatively different impact on us when it comes. I'm reminded of the New Testament story of the Emmaus Road, where the disciples said, did not our hearts burn within us while he spoke with us on the road? That it goes in differently. We begin to recognize God's voice as being distinct from all the other voices, and that only comes through experience.
Let's take a quick call here before our break. This is an anonymous friend listening in on Faith 90.5 in Duluth. Go ahead. You're on with Ruth Barton.
Yes, hello. I guess one of my questions would be, are there certain circumstances that we all go through, you know, upon growing up, that this becomes more difficult for us as adults? Because I guess I can see where children are able to be still a lot easier at times.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you address it. Talk about the childlikeness. Say a word about that.
Yeah, that the child is really the metaphor that the psalmist uses to describe this experience of solitude and silence. He says in Psalm 131, O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me, but I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. That is the metaphor, that's the picture that the psalmist uses to describe a soul at rest in God. And it is very childlike, a child who has been well cared for, weaned, you know, he's had his needs met. He knows he can trust his loving mother or his loving parent to meet those needs, so he doesn't have to be frantic and grasping and clinging and afraid, but he can just be quietly with the loving parent near, and the nearness of that parent is what brings peace. That is the experience that we can have with God, and I think it is true. Now, children who haven't been well cared for won't have it either. They will also be frantic because they haven't been used to having their needs cared for. So well cared for children would have that experience of being able to be still and quiet in the presence of the one who loves them. But oftentimes, yes, the culture pulls us in, and then we start to have our more adult ways of reasoning and thinking that we're going to care for ourselves, and we start to have anxieties and take more on ourselves than we should. We start finding it difficult to rest in God because now we think we're supposed to do everything for ourselves, you know, and we're more aware of the complexities in the world, and so it becomes more difficult to trust God. So trusting God becomes part of the discipline here, is that we learn to trust God like a well-cared-for child has learned to trust his loving mother or father.
Invitation to Solitude and Silence with Ruth Haley Barton. Ruth, before we take a break, maybe just take a minute or two and offer another, maybe just a little sample of ways that we can put this into practice day by day.
Well, what could be nice, I think, in regards to the last segment that we had, is to perhaps remember moments of being like a child, to get in touch with the child-like experiences that you've had, times when you've been aware of being well in your soul and feeling trustful and at peace, especially early experiences. And just notice whether that's how you feel in your relationship with God, and if not, try to return to that place of being a little bit more childlike and letting go of all your adult hard work and effort and clinging and grasping and agenda. Just try to be more like a child and remember what it was like to be a child and return to that a little bit in your memory and see if you can't bring a little bit more of that into your relationship with God.
Good words today from Ruth Haley Barton. We'll talk some more in just a moment. Ruth is a spiritual director, teacher, author, and retreat leader. And she's founder of the Transforming Center. It's a ministry of spiritual formation to pastors and Christian leaders, along with the congregations and organizations they serve. And the book we're referencing is called Invitation to Solitude and Silence, Experiencing God's Transforming Presence. Learning more about that and how we can experience God more and enjoy and remember what it means to rest in Him and experience His peace. We'll talk more with Ruth in just a moment here on Connecting Faith.
What are you willing to do to go beyond the call? This is Wayne Peterson, president of HCJB Global. As Marsha read through a magazine, she came upon an unusual story. This article talked about a group of friends who often got together to do potluck with the sole purpose of raising funds for those in need in their community by using the money normally spent at a restaurant. Marsha was struck by the idea of using dining out dollars to help others, so for her birthday, she asked her friends to join her in a meal for a good cause, and that night, they raised $700. That was 10 years ago. Today, Marsha runs a ministry called Dining for Women. With over 9,200 active members, these women are making a difference in the lives of thousands of women around the world. Have a good idea? Well, go for it, and go beyond the call. This is Wayne Peterson. What is God asking you to do today? Make it a day that you go beyond the call. And then visit us online at hcjb.org.
Forty-nine past the hour. Talking today with Ruth Haley Barton about the invitation to solitude and silence, experiencing God's transforming presence. You know, much of our faith and practice is about words, preaching, teaching, talking with others, all those good things. And the words aren't enough to take us into the real presence of God where we can hear His voice. And we're getting some great insight from Ruth about that today. One of our callers, Ruth, said, what do you say to someone who feels like their prayers bounce off the ceiling whenever they try to meet with God?
That's a good question. And part of that, I think, has to do with stage of faith and stages of our prayer life, that there is a time in our prayer lives where our words start to fail and to be less satisfying, and interacting with God at the level of words no longer is as fulfilling as it used to be. And that is a signal, actually, that there is something new that God is bringing forth in our prayer. And so part of the challenge there, it is an invitation to solitude and silence, I think. When that starts to happen, when words start to fail, and there's no longer the intimacy with God in the realm of words, that God is inviting us into this deeper kind of communion that is beyond words. And beyond words communion in a human relationship, it's something we can understand in certain human relationships where, for instance, the love and the intimacy that passes between a child, a baby, and a parent, especially a nursing mother, is totally beyond words, and yet it's still real. You know, it doesn't require words at all, and words aren't even possible because babies can't say words. They don't need it. But they feel all that love that's happening in a more skin-to-skin way, if you will. It's beyond words. Same with lovemaking between a husband and a wife. You know, there are times when the words fail and you just want to show each other that you love each other on a whole different level. And so what's required in these times is to be willing to let go of the way that we've experienced our life with God primarily through words and begin to experience God more in that communion sort of way. So even though the experience of having our words grow cold or feeling like our words are bouncing off against the ceiling feels painful and uncomfortable at first, but if we can just let go and trust ourselves into God, I think they're great gifts and actually more substantive experiences of God's presence that are there for us if we can trust God and let go of some of the typical ways that we've related to God.
Say a little bit about, in the last chapter of the book, you mentioned a quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer that talks about, you know, let him who cannot be alone beware of community, and let him who is not in community beware of being alone. Talk about the importance of community, and can we take this to extreme, I suppose, like everything else?
Yes, absolutely. And Bonhoeffer's statement is so wonderful because it's so balanced. We are meant to be alone with God and to have those intimate one-on-one experiences with God, and God has also placed us in community with brothers and sisters, and that too is a part of our transformation. The danger is one without the other. So if we're not practicing solitude and encountering God in solitude and silence and having God's presence be what gives us our sense of identity and worth and fulfillment and satisfaction, then in the human community, we become somewhat dangerous because we're asking the community to fulfill needs that only God can meet. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We become dangerous. I mean, I'm using that word seriously to say we become dangerous in the human community because we're asking people to give us what only God can give, to satisfy needs that only God can satisfy, and that's dangerous. The opposite is also true, that when we're in solitude without being in community, we can become convinced that we're very pious and perfect and it's easy to be humble in God's presence, not so easy to be humble in the presence of our very human brothers and sisters. So in the human community, we stop believing our own press. We realize that we still have some growing up to do. We're challenged to learn how to be selfless and to serve others. Bob Mulholland, in his book, Invitation to a Journey, talks about the fact that in community, other people become agents of God's troubling grace. In other words, we rub the rough edges off of each other as we tumble up together in the community. And there are transformative possibilities in community that we can avoid by being in solitude so much that we're not in community meaningfully anymore. So both are very dangerous. One without the other, either way, is dangerous.
Ruth, if people want to find out a little bit more about the center, is there a website where they can go to on that?
Yes. www.thetransformingcenter.org. And we offer all sorts of help and spiritual formation ministries to pastors, but the heart of what we do is what we call the Transforming Community, which is a 2-year experience of transforming community for pastors and Christian leaders. So they commit themselves to 8 or 9 quarterly retreats over 2 years of time, and it's a community that commits itself to each other and to us. And we journey together in very intentional ways over 2 years of time. And so we have a retreat on each one of the spiritual disciplines that we would consider to be crucial. So there's a whole 2.5-day retreat on solitude and silence, on a leader's journey into solitude and silence. So you can go to our website and find out about those communities and other things that we offer. Lots of transforming resources as well, books and things like that that we offer in our online store.
We only have maybe about 30 seconds left. I don't know if there's a sort of a final word of encouragement for those that want to experience a clear presence of God. What would you say?
I would say pay attention to your desire and let it even deepen into desperation if you need to, because deep human desire can have a significant impact on the outcome of our human situation. And I really believe that human beings eventually choose what they want the most. And so if you can let yourself be in touch with how deep your desire goes, how bad you want an encounter with God, and how bad you want to walk closely with Him, and even let it become desperation, because desperation, as we know, causes us to be open to solutions that we might not otherwise be open to. So desperation is a good thing in the spiritual life. Let's not do this out of a sense of ought or should, or because Ruth Haley Barton was talking about it on the radio today. We enter into these disciplines because we want it and we need it, and we're willing to rearrange our lives to make space for it.
Talking today with Ruth Haley Barton. The book is called Invitation to Solitude and Silence, and we're going to wrap up the show today with an opportunity to take a couple minutes just to quiet yourself before the Lord.
Shit.